I want to give you a chance before we break for coffee. Does anybody have any questions for any of the speakers? Hans?
Yeah, I have a question to Michelle from the Harvard University. In Europe, we have a lot of debate about the wording what we use about social entrepreneurship, social business, business of social sustainability impact. You know, we enter in a new decade of making business, and we're using different frameworks. Do Harvard have a clear definition about what is social entrepreneur, what's the difference on social enterprise and social business? And for the colleague from India government, it's great to be inspired by a man like Professor Yunus, but the following processes had nothing to do with this, what Professor Yunus is teaching on the business aspect. So I would love to share the real idea about how to do social business and as well on the private-public partnership in it. Thank you.
Thanks, Hans. So, Michelle, do you want to...
Well, I must confess I don't really know the answer. I mean, Rosbeth Kanter teaches at the Harvard Business School. I know there's a number of people there. I cannot tell you exactly. I know that students are flocking to this. I know that Rakesh Khurana had them sign a whole thing about something like 75% of the students who received an MBA last year signed a kind of ethic compact, right? So it's a huge social movement, but I'm not so plugged into it that I know the details. I don't know if someone else does, but do you? No?
The fact that I think there is different facets to answer your question. I think you may wanted to know technically what are the type of social business that they are talking about, and I don't think that it is the definition that Professor Yunus is referring. As to this, what is his name, the business school professor?
Rakesh Khurana.
Yeah, Rakesh does very, very good work in terms of mainstreaming ethics into business training, and in a very engaging way, like what you're talking is getting indeed a signature for a whole class, I think, almost graduating in terms of, and not just signing your name at the bottom of a letter, but really kind of articulating what will it mean when you are in practice to weave those principles.
Yeah, for ethical business.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
Since I'm here, I may as well ask a question.
Well, can I just, Ramchandra, do you want to respond to anything that Hans said about what you were talking about? No, it's all right. It's on.
Okay. The context in which the Muhammad Yunus we quoted was in the power of or the nature of institutions and policies which are at the disposal of the government, and if they are appropriately used and combined with the partnership of the private sector and the following the entrepreneurial model, I was not saying that they are 100% in conformity or in line or teaching of the Muhammad Yunus, but only I was emphasizing on the power and role of the instruments and policy and institution which can create sea change if used properly, and the examples which I gave, that was the message which we are trying to drive home.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, that's a question that I'd like to address to each of you in turn. I think, Tom, in what you're presenting, it is basically, if I followed you correctly, a kind of a revisit of something that was achieved for the goods of business and community that was targeted in the 70s and are now taken back, not all relying on government, but using market mechanism as market mechanism and collaboration as kind of governance, if I may say. I think it is easier to do that in the context of physical goods, physical service. You need transportation, you need hubs for carrying your food and so on. When it gets to poverty, when it gets to social issues, even though we know we can talk about productivity of business and all the good things that health does, but it's much, much less clearly evident. So what First time did I understand correctly what you were presenting, and I'd like to have your thoughts as well as I think Michelle is also, you. How can we learn from the more effective, I think, market mechanism when there is a concrete win-win in terms of actual function than when we get to the more human stuff of dealing with poverty and health inequity?
Should I speak? Just several points. One, I think that for me, if you think about vegetables, I like to think maybe too low, you know, style, but, you know, if you just think about vegetables versus producing wheat for subsistence on a farm in Uttar Pradesh, where it is one of the biggest, it's 180 million person state, one of the biggest concentrations of poverty. And, of course, India has the greatest concentration of poverty in the world and malnutrition. And so you go to the biggest state and you say, if these people shifted from subsistence wheat to vegetables, they quadruple their income. Okay, so it's four times more on the given land for vegetables or fruit. Now, the market for vegetables or fruit, if there isn't any kind of external outlet, quickly becomes saturated and the prices go down and you don't earn that four times. So you really need to have external market outlets, let's say, to urban areas. Whether those are modern markets or other kinds of markets, the conditions of the market then determine whether you can raise your income. If the incidence of poverty will then also be a function of whether you can raise your income. So to me, the relation between vegetable markets, you know, I've watched this in the west of UP, potatoes took over from rice and wheat in this area very quickly over the past certain number of years. Incomes have increased a lot, and poverty incidence has gone down a lot based on this sort of horticulture, agricultural diversification. So to me, poverty is not a general intangible thing. It has very much to do with how much money do you make. Okay, and if you can get more money into the hands of the people, then you have less poverty, right? Now, that might not be true for malnutrition or health, so I'll turn to that second. I'm not a health expert. I would say that what I do see is that there is a relationship between these hubs that are being established, either by public sector anchors or private sector anchors, where they're saying, look, there's a tremendously low rate of supply of health services in this area. Not of health facilities. There's a tremendously low rate of supply of extension services in this area, not extension agents. There's a million, you know, thousands and thousands of extension agents there. There's thousands of health centers in these villages. It's all on paper, right? And so you ask yourselves, what are the ways that incentives could increase? You know, obviously, what Mr. Mishra is talking about ways of making the government accountable for delivering those services is a massive first step. A second step is finding ways to link productive services in other domains with reducing the transaction costs and increasing the certitude of being able to source certain kinds of health and education services. So, for example, they're trying in either the public version or the private version of these platforms to have health facilities. Apollo hospitals, Fortis, all of these are entering into joint ventures with these sorts of platforms around India to place either virtual hospitals there where they have internet hookup, they have pharmacies, they have health center. The farmers and their families come in to deliver, and then they have access to the health services. Now, is that, I would say that that's not a generalized solution, obviously, to the health and education problem by any means. It's sort of incremental based on jujitsu of using these sorts of platform and hub and cluster things to add other services. But the point is that when you say services, it need not be just fertilizer and credit. It can also be health, which it is in these cases. Now, they're also thinking of that's a way to make a lot of money because there's a lot of dearth of those services in rural areas, and the public sector is wasting the money and not providing those services. You know, so how do you combine also the formation of farmer companies that aggregate product for these kinds of market outlets with also health services and education aggregate opportunities for the farmer.
Hey, Thomas, I want to let Michelle to come in, and if you have something you wanted to say, Michelle, on the same subject.
Yeah. Or,
no, please.
Okay, well, it seems to me there's one thing that no one has mentioned so far, the experiment in budgetary democracy, the famous experiments of Kerala and Porto Alegre, which really creates a culture of the collective decision-making, and it seems to me that we could address your question in part by thinking in terms of how political cultures are transformed through these kinds of exercise and may eventually facilitate forms of public-private collaboration. Mm. So in our book, Peter Evans, who's an expert in development, has a wonderful chapter that deals with some of these things. Mm-hmm.
Ramchandra, did you want to add?
I just wanted to mention, as you said, that when it comes to the poverty alleviation program or delivery of services related, it's hard to find. But there also we can find a connection there. Ultimately, this also gets linked to the delivery of some physical goods and services to alleviate poverty. For example, as I mentioned in my example of National Rural Employment Guarantee Program, it's basically the poverty food security program. Now, the delivery of the benefit to the right people, it was given a business model. Improving the living conditions of the slum dwellers through a business model, It certainly enhances the quality of the life of the poor people. It does require a little more innovation, but certainly it's possible.
Yeah, the coffee's going to be cold if we don't get out there now. So let's take a break for 15 minutes, okay? And then we'll come back. Thanks to all of them.